Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Never mind Slumdog Millionaire for a moment. My guest today is more like software billionaire, India style. We're not in the slums of Mumbai here, but in the gleaming Indian software capital of Bangalore. Nandan Nilekani was one of a young team of engineers who founded Infosys. As the global economy took off, so did their firm, to the stars. Now, this global economy is in crisis. This hour, On Point, we'll ask Nandan Nilekani how it all looks from India. You can join the conversation. If the world is flat, what do you need to hear from India about how we all get out of this mess? Do you see India as an economic partner, an economic problem? Joining me now from New York City is Nandan Nilekani. He's a co-founder and now co-chairman of Infosys Technologies, based in Bangalore and one of India's largest IT companies, information technology. In 2006, Time magazine listed him as one of the world's 100 most influential people, and Forbes named him Businessman of the Year for Asia. New York Times columnist and author Tom Friedman made Nandan Nilekani a global brand in his book, The World is Flat. Nilekani's new book is Imagining India, the Idea of a Renewed Nation. Nandan Nilekani, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be on your show.
You're really getting the grand American tour. You're on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart last night. He wound up welcoming you as his overlord, the new Indian, you know, overlord of the world economy. How do you feel about that?
No, I think that was a little over the top. But I think it's been a great time so far, and I think it's really a good time. And my book is really even seeing a lot of interest here.
So look out on the big global economy with us for a second. You, of course, with Infosys, along with big companies in India like Wipro and Tata Consultancy, huge tech support giants, built a base, you know, sorting out Western firms' software problems. Now Western firms are in big trouble. What about Indian firms?
Well, I think relative to what's happening in the world, India is less affected. Obviously, it's affected because capital flows have turned back. The growth of exports has slowed down, and so on and so forth. But India has a lot of fundamental things going in its favor: a young economy, a young demographics, high savings rate, a banking system which is robust, good regulations. So while it has certainly been affected by this slowdown, and India's growth rates have dropped from 8 to 9% to 5-6%, relatively, I think India is in a better position than many other countries in the world.
You know, a few months back, when things really started to crumble in the American economies and European economy, people looked out toward Asia, China, India, and wondered, hey, is it possible that even if we're falling off a cliff here, that the Asian economies might pick up the slack, might become the engine that pulls the world economy? That did not happen. Will that ever happen?
No, I think that was, I think, a bit unrealistic. One is clearly the size of these economies is much smaller. I mean, the U.S. is a $14 trillion economy. The Chinese may be around $3 trillion. The Indian is a trillion. Mm. And clearly, they just don't have the size. The second thing is, to a large extent, all these countries are interdependent. I mean, the Chinese have about 35% of the GDP coming from exports. India has about 17% of GDP coming from exports. They all depend on global capital flows, capital to finance trade. So, you know, the thing is so much more interlinked. I think it's very difficult in this highly global environment for any one country to stand aloof and believe it won't be impacted by the slowdown.
So if Asia can't pull the train, the whole world has to, or maybe still the U.S. has to. You depend in no small part of that. What do you think of how Washington is doing so far in the face of this crisis?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, for us, about 60% of our revenue comes from the United States. So clearly, the U.S. recovery is an important part of our business future. And I think, I think the administration is trying very hard. I think they have begun with a bad set of cards. And I think they're trying what they can. But I think the situation is very, very complex. And I do wish them all the best in an early recovery.
As everybody's struggling to make it through this time, how do you think, Nandan Nilekani, how should Americans Look at you, your firm, firms like yours, call centers and software and systems contracts, you know, taken off to India in your case. Are you, for Americans trying to dig out of a hole, are you friend or foe in economic terms?
Well, I think, you know, we believe that free trade globally is an important thing to raise standards of living and growth in every part of the world. And we contribute in adding value to our customers around the world, including in the U.S. So we believe that we are definitely a friend. And we also believe that, you know, India's economic growth is equally important to drive markets. India has the advantage that it's a large consumer market. Two-thirds of the Indian GDP is local consumer spending. And if India grows back at 6, 7, 8% a year for many years, it'll also be a huge market for the world. So I do believe that it's very important that we have trade across countries. Otherwise, if we all end up with protectionism, then I think we will run the risk of having a longer recession.
And what about your vision, India's plans for really going to the stars? You have big pockets now. And of course, Bangalore and your company, 300-acre campus, absolutely gorgeous. Everybody doing great by Indian standards and in many ways by global standards. But with this economic meltdown, are you having to put your vision on hold? Are you wondering if it will ever come to pass?
Well, I think certainly this slowdown affects us included in this whole scenario. But I think the fundamental thing that we have created, a world-class company, attracting the best talent globally and helping provide business solutions to our clients, I think that value proposition continues to be compelling no matter what the economic scenario.
That sounds, I mean, Tom Friedman says you're an optimist but not naive. But if Western economies don't do a whole lot better than they're doing now, I don't see how you can be prosperous, you know, being the back end for companies that are failing.
No, certainly I think, you know, if Western companies face challenges, then some of those challenges do get transmitted to us. But I do believe, I think, you know, we are finding that there is business still in this environment. A lot of the things that we do are critical for companies to run and function. They're all mission critical. So I think that very much continues.
A lot of Americans feel like they were living in a bubble for years, and many of us bought into it. You know, stock values were going up, home prices were going up, everything looked dandy. Now economic indicators on all sides have receded, and things don't look so great. People are reconsidering some basic assumptions. How has the economic downturn affected your analysis of the global economy and what's coming?
Well, I think clearly the bubble had distorted, you know, what people were doing in every country. I mean, clearly in the U.S. they were spending a lot and not saving. In China, they were saving a lot and not spending. In India, we had 4 or 5 years of 8 to 9% growth. And we, in turn, because of that growth, started a lot of spending, which now in retrospect looks like it can't be supported by current government revenue. So I think every country in some way got distorted in its approach to what's happening. And in some sense, this economic crisis is a message to all of us to go back to basics and look at creating fundamental value for everyone.
You know, of course, India was a socialist country pretty much for a long time. It's only kind of in the time of your career that it's come out, been more market-oriented. You're a big figure in a kind of cheerleader for market dynamics in India. Now President Obama, Barack Obama, is trying to bring some more government back in this country, more regulation back. Republican critics, some of them, are crying socialism. As someone who actually grew up in a socialist country that went market, how do you see the conversation going on in the States today about where it's headed?
No, I think certainly it's a very interesting conversation and something one would not have predicted a few years back. But I do believe that any society today needs the right balance between governments and markets. I think we need markets, we need entrepreneurs, because they are the ones who are creative, who create jobs, who create new products and services, who make the economy more efficient. So we very much need them, and we should treat them as important social players. At the same time, I think we need good regulation and governments to create a level playing field and to remove incentives for bad economics. So I think I feel that we have to strike a balance between use of market forces and a strong role for the government.
So when the market orthodox look at President Obama and say, he's taking a socialist, how does that look to you? How does it sound to you?
No, I think he's trying to address a lot of very important things. He's trying to address the issue of healthcare. He's trying to address the fact that education needs a lot of investment. He's trying to address infrastructure which may have fallen behind. He's trying to ensure that the world goes to a greener economy, you know, in an era of global warming. So I think these are all very legitimate and very good public objectives. I think the challenge is all this is happening in an economic downturn, and that's where I think it makes a lot of people nervous.
Did you like Slumdog Millionaire?
Well, I think it was a very racy movie, and but in some sense, it played to certain standard notions of India, which India is far more complex and far more nuanced than the book than the movie, obviously.
Too much slum in this movie? India still has a lot of poverty.
No, it does, but I think there is a lot happening in India. Clearly, it's a country of enormous diversity. You have these large slums, you have very modern campuses and cities. We have a lot of very educated engineers who work in the technology sector. At the same time, we have a large number of people who are uneducated. So it's clearly a country of which sort of simultaneously lives in the 17th century and the 21st century at the same time. So clearly it's a country of enormous diversity. But fundamentally, I think it's a country where where it's opened up and is now on the verge of achieving a great deal, provided we do the right things.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with India's high-tech business superstar, Nandan Nilekani, about the global economic crisis from India's point of view and what comes next for this rising power, India. His new book is Imagining India, the Idea of a Renewed Nation. He is very big in that country and its economy. Think Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Steve Jobs, and you're in the realm of Nandan Nilekani. He was an inspiration to Tom Friedman, who wrote the book The World is Flat. Says he got the phrase, heard the phrase from my guest today, Nandan Nilekani. Nandan Nilekani is a co-founder, now co-chairman of Infosys Systems, part of that big wave of jobs that went to India in call centers and software systems contracts, tasks going to where the cheapest solutions could be found, underpins an awful lot of globalization and is one of the bedrocks of India's economy now. He joins us today from New York. And Nandan Nilekani, we have listeners who want to speak with you. Guy in Stamford, Connecticut, you're on the air with Mr. Nilekani.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, my question is that, you know, I do quite a bit in the IT world, and I get on a tech support line, and I find myself talking to someone in India, and it always feels a bit offensive to me is that there's so many Americans out of work today, and someone in India has a job that could be given to someone in America. And if we were to do something such as a tariff that would place a labor tariff on Indian labor, so that we would put Indian workers on an equal basis with American workers and competing for those jobs, how would that affect the Indian economy, and could you survive that? And then another question is, I've heard recently on the news that in India Christians are being persecuted, and I was wondering what that's all about.
Nandan Nilekani?
Yeah, I think clearly, obviously, I'm not in favor of any kind of protectionism, and because I do believe that this creates jobs on both sides. I mean, just to give you a sense, the Indian economy is also a big importer of products from all over the world, including the United States. We just placed a huge order for U.S. Planes. So I think, you know, trade goes both ways. It creates jobs in both countries. And I think anything which encourages creating barriers, as it happened during the Depression, will only prolong the problems that we have. So I really don't think that that's a great idea. I think you're referring to, there have been a couple of episodes, but I think overall, India is a very strong secular country. It believes in the rule of law. It does a great deal to protect the minorities.
You mean episodes of acts against religious minorities, Christians?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. But I think we have a very strong civil society, and I think people have reacted very firmly to put down any efforts to persecute anyone.
Guy, what do you say? It's good for everyone. So, IT may lose some jobs. Boeing may gain some. Does that satisfy you?
Not really. I don't buy it. I think that American workers should be economically, salary wise, on an even keel, and the best people should be able to get the jobs, not because they're working for less.
Nandan Nilekani, how do your wages now compare with wages for comparably skilled, educated workers in the United States in the IT field?
I think certainly the salary levels there in dollar terms are lower, but if you look in terms of purchasing power, they are comparable. It's also, I think, not just about cost. I think it's about quality. It's about innovation. It's about expertise built up over many, many years. So I think there's a whole lot to it in the mix.
And what about American competitiveness? It's not just about wages. There's been a lot of attention paid to the rising standard of technological expertise in India. Do you see your company, your country, competing on the strength of lower wages, on the strength of intellectual firepower? And if it's the latter, who has the advantage, the U.S. or India?
No, I think the U.S. Continues to be the world's largest economy, a great innovative economy, an open society where creativity is valued. So I think, these are all extraordinary achievements of the United States. I think in India, we do have certainly an economic advantage, but it's also about, I think, a lot of intellectual capital that's now being created. It's about innovation. It's about high-quality systems that we have built. So I think, I think it's not a zero-sum game. I don't think it's the rise of one at the cost of another. I think it's about trying to use the global economy to improve the quality of life and standard of living around the world.
Let's go to Jack in Montreal, Canada. Jack, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. A great show. I'd like to ask the gentleman, I used to work for Novotel for several years, and I've been laid off, and I'm sure he knows that the company's gone bust and is applying for bankruptcy. What if I went to India and worked for him? What kind of salary conditions would I get? Would I get a pension benefit or health benefits? And would he hire a guy with me, like me, who's worked for Nortel all these years?
Mr. Nilekani, how about it?
Well, I think, obviously someone with his experience would definitely be someone we would look at. He would have to go through the interview process like everybody else.
But do you mean that literally? Seriously, you would? You're open to applications from anywhere in the world, from Canada?
Oh, sure.
US?
I mean, we have young Americans working for us in India. So there's no issue. We have people from around the world working for us, including in India. But I in terms of the salary and so on, obviously it would be based on the salary that we have in India for people of his experience. In terms of we would have a health insurance scheme. We would have contributions to retirement plans, not necessarily to the Canadian one, but to the one which operates in India, and all the other stuff which goes with the proper job.
Jack, are you ready to ship off an application? Are you serious?
Well, it sounds very tempting because we have a lot of Indian, Canadians working for Nortel here. So why shouldn't some of us go over there and help out with the company over there?
Jack, please feel free to send me an email with your application. I'll follow it up.
Okay, sir.
Let us know how that goes, Jack. We'll be curious. Let's get a call from Detroit, Michigan. Anita, you're on the air with Nandan Nilekani, Anita.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because I wanted to ask a question. The standard of education you have in India, you guys produce so many highly educated people. Your focus is on education. And I want to know, what do you think about how America can shift their focus to education, because the level of education our students graduate and the low dropout rate that we have, the high dropout rate that we have here, our students are not graduating at the same pace, so we can't even keep up considering the poverty level in India. What do you think about that?
Thanks, Anita. Nandan Nilekani?
Well, I think even in India, education is a mixed bag. For higher education and for technical education of the kind that we hire, yes, there is a good system and we have a lot of graduates. But we also have a high level of illiteracy among children. Our primary education is still not 100% there. We also have a high dropout. So we have some of the same challenges in some parts of our education economy. I think in the United States, I think it is a great place for education, but I do believe that there are more things to be done. And I think one of the objectives of the current administration is really to focus on improving the quality of public schools. And we have very similar challenges in India.
Anita's question is interesting. Last night with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, he asked you, what's lots of promise, but what's India's biggest pitfall, biggest peril? And you replied, Indian education. Why?
See, it's because, you know, there is a segment of the education which is excellent, but mass education for all the people, especially for the poor, is still very uneven in its quality. And that's where the challenge is because, you know, India is going through its demographic dividend, which means it has the highest pool of young people anywhere in the world. And the schools are simply not able to cope with this huge mass of students and provide good quality education. And that will decide whether we have an educated workforce that can contribute to the economy or whether you'll end up with people who don't have the skills to operate in today's world.
You know, your companies like yours have put a certain face on India that's quite glossy. When you talk with Americans, do you have a feeling that they understand? Maybe now after Slumdog Millionaire, you think they're tilted the other way. But do they understand how much poverty remains in India?
Yes, I think, you know, India has a little of everything. It has, you know, very high-tech industries like ours. It has widespread poverty on the other side. It has gleaming cities and large slums. So, you know, and in some sense, the purpose of my book is really to explain these contradictions. And I've tried to do that because the questions from people were of the nature that I'm getting on this call.
Mm. Mustafa in Boston, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind, Mustafa?
Yes. I just want to comment on the economic growth in India. You say, the gentleman, your guest, saying that it's growing 5 to 6%. It's a little bit higher than the U.S.
Down from 8 or 9%, red hot, just a couple of years ago.
Right. And probably the same thing is happening in China. But the economic growth, I mean, if you look at it, if you ignore half of the Indian population, I would say it's still doing good. But when you look at the income per capita, it's still it needs 20 to 30% growth, and it needs to spread all around from top to bottom, which I don't see it in India, unfortunately. So economic growth, for an average Indian person, doesn't mean anything. Things need to change socially, politically in India. The same thing, I believe, in China.
Mustafa, this goes right to Nandan Nilekani's big themes in his book Imagining India. Nandan Nilekani, Mustafa says, it looks great if you ignore half the population. Your book is all about sort of what India needs to do to realize its full potential.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. Speak to that.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I make the point that India is at a very unique point in its history because of its demographic dividend, because of the quality of its entrepreneurs.
Its demographic dividend meaning it has an extraordinarily young population, 10 years younger on average than China, never mind old growing countries like Japan.
Yeah, and the bulk of the population is of working age, which is mm-hmm. where this demographic dividend really helps because the less people dependent and more people working. So we have the demographic dividend. We have great entrepreneurs. We have technology, which is empowering. It's a country where 8 million mobile phones are sold every month. We have the English language, which is a language of global business. We have global factors in our favor because we are a young country in an aging world. And we have a deep-rooted democracy. So I believe these are very strong assets that India has, but these assets are only meaningful if it addresses the issues that Mustafa talked about, which is education, healthcare, infrastructure, governance improvements. And my book really goes through all these issues.
And what about the issue of social cohesion? You do have religious fundamentalists, Hindu fundamentalists at work in India. We have seen some of those conflicts. And then you've got a rough neighborhood sometimes. We saw what happened in Mumbai. You've got Pakistan and its troubles next door. How do those pieces fit together?
No, I mean, obviously, I think instances of communal, you know, disharmony between religious groups. But as you know, look at the scale of the whole mm-hmm. thing. I think we have to see it in the context of the scale. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you have a billion people out there. You have every known religion practicing there. You have Hindus and Christians and Buddhists and Jains and Jews and every category of people are there. Given the scale of what we have and given the level of relative economic deprivation that we have, I think it's a very peaceful country.
You know, I spent a year in India when I was still a teenager arriving there. That is a few moons back now. But when I look at India today, it's just remarkable. I mean, this was just during the emergency, Indira Gandhi's time. And now here we are looking at companies like yours. It's an astonishing transformation of parts, not all, but big parts of India.
Yeah. No, I truly believe, Tom, that India is really a very interesting country because you have a billion people with full democracy, with full human rights, trying to navigate itself from its position to getting better and making its country more prosperous. So it is really an exciting story to watch.
I'm talking with Nandan Nilekani, co-chairman of Infosys Technologies, huge in India and around the world. His new book is Imagining India. Let's get a call from Michael in Ashford, Connecticut. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a positive comment about the quality of the Bangalore programming team that my group worked with from Stamford, Connecticut, almost 10 years ago now, which I think was probably right near the beginning of India's Infosys
takeoff.
But they were just so much fun to work with and so very bright and energetic, and any kind of suggestion that we would make about a certain piece of code, they would implement the changes. There's the illusion of everything happening overnight because of the time zone difference, so that it's hard not to be a big fan of what they're doing in Bangalore, even as I'm aware that it's an elite education and that we're talking to a very privileged segment of their society.
Michael, thank you for that kind of witness.
Yeah.
Nandan, I wonder, what is the balance that you get of criticism and embrace when you're traveling in the States, talking with Americans?
No, I think, of course, first of all, I'd like to thank Michael for that great testimonial. I think, a lot of people who have experienced working with us and other firms like us say similar things because we do bring a lot of energy and passion and commitment and hard work to the table. At the same time, I can understand the concerns that people have about jobs. And I do believe, and one could argue that I have a vested interest, but I do believe that at the end, it's a net positive in terms of job creation. I think, India is a country which is selling 8 million mobile phones a month. Now, those mobile phones are really made by global companies like Motorola or Ericsson or Nokia or Samsung. Similarly, India is becoming a big buyer of planes, and those planes are made by Boeing and Airbus. So I think, this trade is really a two-way street, and I think both economies have to prosper for us to create jobs in both locations. I think any attempt to narrow it down would be self-defeating.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with India's high-tech business superstar, Nandan Nilekani, about the global economic crisis from India's point of view and what comes next for this rising power. He's out with a new book, Imagining India, The Idea of a Renewed Nation. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from an Indian-American entrepreneur looking back at Nandan Nilekani's world. Desh Deshpande will join us. Nandan Nilekani joins us from New York. Let's get a call from Boston. Aparna is on the line. Hi, Aparna. You're on the air with Nandan Nilekani.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm an electrical engineer from India, and I work for a company that contributes majorly towards the American economy. But while I feel that I'm contributing to the American economy, I sometimes don't like to hear about the bad way the outsourcing is kind of portrayed. So I was wondering how India can become autonomous the business world, rather than just being catering to a consumer market from other countries? How can it become independent?
That's a great question. To move away beyond outsourcing and have more that's homegrown, Mr. Neelakani.
Well, I think I really don't think we are at a point where countries can go back and just stick to doing what they need inside their economies. I think global trade and global movement of goods and services is here to stay. And notwithstanding the current economic crisis and the calls to protectionism, I do believe that this is a part of the, you know, open global economy that we need. At the same time, I think there's very much a point that India also has to continue to do its internal reforms so that India becomes a much bigger single market, infrastructure improves so that goods and services can be delivered better internally, education improves, and so forth. And that, I believe, is very much required, because I think the one of the messages from the meltdown is that countries must have a balanced portfolio of business, some from inside the country and some from the international economy.
I mean, I don't think, unless I misunderstand, I don't think Aparna is asking about sealing off, but I remember reading late last year in the New York Times, Jeremy Connor, someone was writing that about how the downturn has hit companies like yours, and saying India's become the world's back office, you know, handling customer service calls and process payments and software backroom accounting, but it hasn't yet become the head office, making major new products, pioneering marketing techniques, helping to shape corporate strategy. How, when does that happen? Is that happening?
No, I think that
for you.
Yeah, no, I think that that is happening, Tom. I mean, if you look at a product that we have called Finacle, which is a global banking platform, you know, it's installed in 40 countries with 100 banks, including the U.S. So it's clearly, you know, our product, which is sold globally, or what the Tata Group has done with a car called the Nano, which is going to revolutionize small cars. So I think there are umpteen examples today of original innovation from India, which are being sold both in India and abroad. So I think while outsourcing is certainly a big part of the story, it's not the only story.
Nandan Neelakani is with us today. He's here from India talking about the future of that country. We're asking him about the future of the global economy. Let's get a perspective from this side of the Pacific. We're joined now from Palo Alto in California by Gururaj Desh Deshpande. He's a serial and very successful entrepreneur, Indian-born, but has lived for a long time and prospered in the United States, co-founder of Cascade Communications and Sycamore Networks, where he's chairman of the board. Desh Deshpande, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I think you've been listening a bit there. You hear, you know, what we've become accustomed to, Americans admiring on the one hand, and at the same time concerned about losing jobs to India, maybe more than ever now that the economy is so rough here. Do you see two compatible partners economically going forward, or do companies like Nandan's, you know, represent a drain on American jobs, Desh?
Well, you know, whatever little good that has happened in India is because of people like Nandan, its innovation and entrepreneurship. And that's what U.S. is really good at.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, sometimes we tend to forget that. And so, you know, when I look at places like MIT and so on, I mean, that's, these are all very unique places that only U.S. can have. And so, and to be massively entrepreneurial and innovative, you have to take advantage of all the capabilities around the globe. So if you corner yourself and then say, this is all I have to work with as an entrepreneur, you really cannot build a globally competitive business.
But you say a place like MIT, only the U.S. can have. But, of course, you've got the Indian Institute of Technology. Nandan Neelakani himself, a graduate there. I mean, as he achieves more success, companies like his, you know both sides of this equation. Do you see the U.S. position as secure in spite of the challenge from India? Is it somehow enhanced by competing with India? How do you look at it, Desh?
You know, it's the level of innovation that you really need to look at the business. For example, you know, I'm doing a rechargeable battery company here in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires, you know, 50 PhDs, 100 masters, huge nanotechnology.
Why not
you
do
know,
it in India?
Those types of companies, there's no way you can do them anywhere else in the world.
Why?
You know?
Why not India?
Because of the level of innovation that you need. You know, I think the innovation in India that's happening is scale and low cost, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very different than what U.S. is capable of. And so, you know, the innovation happens because of circumstances in every different parts of the world.
Well, now this is interesting. Hold that thought, Desh Deshpande. Nandan Nilekani, is that, I'm sure you guys are buddies, but is that kind of insulting that this sort of innovation can only happen in the United States? Do you agree? Do you believe it? Are you all about scale and low cost?
No, I think there's no question that the U.S. is a huge innovative economy, and that must be preserved and enhanced in the coming years. I think India also, there is innovation happening. See, I think Desh's point is that innovation happens in the context of the problem that you're trying to solve. In India, the problem that you're trying to solve is you're trying to create a large market for a lot of consumers who have relatively low purchasing power, who are widely dispersed,
mm-hmm.
and therefore you have to combine scale, quality, price, and that's the innovation. I mean, the Tata Nano is a good example of a high-quality, low-cost car. So I think innovation is entirely in the context of market requirements. In the U.S., the market requirements are different. But I think net-net, I think both kinds of innovations are required. And the U.S. is definitely a very entrepreneurial, very innovative country. And it would be a huge mistake to sort of barricade the borders.
Desh, do you see from inside the U.S. moves toward barricading the borders, protectionist sentiment? Do you see trouble in this downturn for this relationship?
You know, I think the hope, all the stimulus and everything else that we're doing is a one-time fix and not something that we get hooked on. You know, the only way out of this mess for U.S. is to stimulate an enormous amount of innovation and entrepreneurship. Because if you look at every big company in U.S., you know, it's all come out of the new ideas in the last 15, 20 years. So I think, I hope, we don't get hooked onto this, you know, creating jobs in existing companies and doing a lot of shovel-ready projects.
But if you look 10, 20 years down the road, if we have this conversation again, do you expect to see more innovation coming out of India? And what happens to the U.S. competitive edge in that situation, Desh?
Well, you know, I think it's 30 years ago when I started my career, you know, a lot of the innovation always went from here to China and India. And now it's a two-way street. But it's different types of innovation, and people are good at different things. And in 10 years from now, I'm very hopeful for what U.S. can do. For example, you know, if you just look at MIT as an example, the best and the brightest for the last 15 years, they all went to financial engineering.
Mm-hmm. Wall Street.
They're not going to do that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to be engineering new products and services and so on. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of talent in U.S. that can come up with lots of new things. But at the same time, for example, let's say last year, Susan Hockfield went with me to MIT, and she noticed something.
The president of MIT, yes.
President of MIT, and she noticed something very innovative in India. For example, Nandan's company. Nandan's company, mm-hmm. even though people talk about 400,000 graduates in India, you know, the education is still pretty bad. So Nandan's company has found a very innovative way of finding the aptitude of people, hiring them, training them for a couple of months, and then putting them into the job. Now, if we can bring that innovation back to U.S. to get the displaced workers to find their aptitude for a few hundred dollars, train them for $1,000, and get them going again, I think that's innovation that we could bring back from India to U.S.
Nandan, you definitely compete on scale and cost. Do you see India as a fierce competitor to the U.S. 10, 20 years out on leading-edge innovation?
Well, I think clearly in the next 20 years, the development of new innovations will be dispersed, and there'll be innovation in
globally.
India, in
mm-hmm.
China,
mm-hmm.
globally, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, I think India will be very much part of the mix. But again, I don't think innovation is a zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
innovation is the lifeblood of new products and new services. It's the lifeblood of entrepreneurship. It's what creates new kinds of jobs. And the more innovation around the world, different kinds, the better for all of us.
And what do you see as India's relationship with the U.S. as compared to China's looking forward? What's the nature of these two relationships? How similar, how different?
Well, I think India has a very natural relationship with the U.S. I think both are very large democracies. Both have English as the common language. Both are large consumer economies. I think there's a huge amount of presence of very successful Indians in the U.S., like Desh and all his colleagues here. So I think, you know, we recently signed a very good Indo-U.S. nuclear deal, which allowed India to develop peaceful nuclear energy to develop alternative nuclear, I mean, alternative energy and stuff. So I think India and U.S. have a very, very successful relationship. It has been choppy in the past, but I think in the last few years, it's really reached a very good level, and we are confident that it will continue to grow.
Doesn't that agreement also leave room for India to develop nuclear weapons further and have them, Nandan?
No, I think it's really entirely limited to nuclear energy for setting up nuclear power plants and those kind of things.
Let's go to Veronique in Boston. Veronique, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Fascinating conversation. I'm very much attached to India. So I actually have a very small consulting firm in communication, cross-cultural communication.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be French and American, and have opened a spot in Delhi, actually, to have my office over there.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe from the time I've been there that India was the future of the world. It might not happen in my generation, but I think it's really going in that direction. As it was described before, it is completely chaotic. There are a lot of risks. There are a lot of things happening over there. But the energy is incredible. And I think that's something you don't find in the U.S. anymore. Mm. I moved to the U.S. at the end of the 70s, early 80s, and I had that. And I was an entrepreneur here, and I was able to develop in my company and have that energy to do that. I found that again in India.
It's an exciting report. I'm sure there are corners where you can find it here, but you're not feeling it in the same way. Nandan, I want to ask you about China. Like the U.S., it's putting huge money into a stimulus package. We're reading about the major investment in future infrastructure and education that may let China, you know, move yet another great leap forward on the other side of this downturn. Are you worried about India being left out as China and maybe the U.S. make these enormous investments that they hope are forward-looking here? Or is India doing the same?
Oh, well, India is not doing the stimulus as big amounts as China and the U.S. But I think I think there's room for everybody on the planet. I don't think it's this or that. I think China clearly has some huge strengths. It's great at execution. It's demonstrated how it's built itself for the last 30 years. I think India is far more bottom-up and chaotic. But as Veronique mentioned, I think we are the youngest country in a world which is aging, and that a lot of the energy and enthusiasm and dynamism that she's referring to comes from that youth. And it's up to us up to India to take full advantage of its youthfulness. And, you know, that's really the whole theme of my book, which is how does India take advantage of its unique position and really fulfill its potential to be one of the leading countries in the world.
Desh Deshpande in Palo Alto today, how do you see the relative dynamism of these two countries' economies? You hear Veronique giving her nod to India these days. What do you say?
You know, I think India can be a beacon of hope for the 4 or 5 billion people that haven't been a part of the global economy. You know, I was in Haiti last week,
mm-hmm.
and I could see the stark contrast. Haiti does not have Nandan Nilekani's.
Mm.
And so, you know, people probably have per capita income of a little bit higher in Haiti than India, but it's not the same energy like in India. India has, I think, found a way to give hope to these people who have had very little. And bringing that hope to all these countries, I think, is a part of the homeland security. You know, when people have hope, you can negotiate with them. You can get the world structured in a certain way. It's only when people lose hope entirely that we all get into trouble. And if somehow India can package this new energy and export, I think that'll be the biggest contribution India can make.
Desh Deshpande, co-founder of Sycamore Networks, joining us today from Palo Alto. Thank you very much, Desh, for being with us.
Thank you.
Nandan Nilekani, how about it? India as a beacon of hope. That's a turnaround, certainly, from the years I was growing up. Do you see it happening?
Yeah, actually, absolutely. I think India has several things to offer. One is, you know, it represents one-sixth of the world. And if one-sixth of the world can live in an open democratic society with the huge amount of diversity that is there and demonstrate that, that's one part of being a beacon of hope. I think the second is clearly if it's able to pull itself out of its challenges and create a prosperous nation, I think that again proves that other countries can do it. I believe it can be a leader in using clean technology to address the challenge of global warming. I think it's a country where the so-called clash of civilizations can really be brought to, can be resolved. So in every possible way, I think the success of India is important for the whole world.
Well, maybe it's time to steal the pages in this country from your book, Imagining India, the Idea of a Renewed Nation. We'll be dipping into your formula and checking it out, Nandan Nilekani. Thank you very much for being with us today. It's been great having you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. It was a great program. Thank you.
Nandan Nilekani, co-chair of Infosys Technologies. Bill Gates of India, he's been called. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.